history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are heroes around you. Men and women who have risked their lives and gone through things we can only imagine, or in some cases, couldn't even imagine. And we want to make sure that our veterans are honored for their service and sacrifice, that we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And over the next hour, we'll be educated, entertained, and perhaps even inspired, as we are each week, by these stories from our greatest generation. It's very unusual on this show to bring you an interview with a veteran over the telephone, but I think we have pretty good reason to do that today. If you're a regular listener, you'll remember an episode just a couple of weeks ago with Al Scarrett, a 97-year-old Navy veteran in Seattle, who was surprised within the last year by a phone call from the very sailor whose life he had saved on the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill after it had been kamikazed in May of 1945. I mentioned at the time that we hoped to bring you a conversation with that man, the sailor who was saved as well, and today we get to do that with 94-year-old Norm Lastman of Chicago, Illinois. I'm excited to bring you that conversation, but my enthusiasm is also tempered by a sobering reality that underscores the urgency of preserving these veteran stories. You're going to hear Norm talk about Al and the remarkable way in which he came to know him. It's a story told very powerfully in television reporting by WGN-TV. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. It was a book by Robert F. Kennedy's son, Max, that started to fill in some of the blanks in Norm's memory, lost because of the carbon monoxide poisoning he suffered when trapped in the engine room of his aircraft carrier, Norm's involvement with Honor Flight Chicago, and the efforts of a kind-hearted neighbor eventually led to Norm's being able to talk on the phone and even on Skype with the man who saved his life 72 years ago. If you heard Al Scarrett on Hometown Heroes, you know how much it meant to him to learn about Norm. You also heard mentioned that Al, at the time of our interview, was battling leukemia, and I am saddened to report that Norm will never get to experience Al's firm handshake the way I did in Seattle just weeks ago. Al Scarrett passed away on October 6th at the age of 97. I'm so grateful to have shared the time with him that we did, not only to hear his story, but to get a feel for just how special and how giving of a man he was. If you didn't hear Al on the program, you can pull up the full interview at hometownheroesradio.com, and maybe we'll have time to hear a quick clip from that later in the context of Norm's interview today. While Al always wondered who it was he had pulled from that engine room, Norm had no memory from those fateful hours aboard the ship. We're going to get to how that all changed, but let's start, as we do with every veteran, with the early years. Growing up in St. Paul, Minnesota, Norm, what can you tell me about your childhood?
It was nice. I was just, truthfully, when you grew up at that time, it was during your depression, more or less, and you never had much of anything. You enjoyed everything that you had. You know, you walked to school in the snow 13 blocks. I played on the high school football team, and then that's about it. In fact, when I get an opportunity to talk to people, a lot of people, I've never had a date with a girl in high school. I never had the clothes to wear. So that's kind of my high school days.
Do you remember noticing a difference during the Great Depression? Did you notice that things had changed?
Very definitely. I kind of feel that I appreciated everything was given to me, and I expected nothing, and I knew that you had to work. I remember when there was a snowstorm, truthfully, I used to ditch school so we could go out and shovel snow for 25 cents. That's how I made it. And then I brought it home and I had to give it to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
I had a newspaper out for the St. Paul Dispatch. I used to deliver papers at 4 in the morning and the evening. And when I was on the football team, I had my little sister. I taught her how to deliver my papers. But when I collected the money at the end of the month, I had to give it to my dad.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you expected. I never. To me, I have no regrets. I felt thrilled that I could help contribute to the family.
Do you remember as a boy having some ideas, hey, when I grow up, here are the things that I'm going to do? Did you have some of those ambitions?
No. I think the biggest first big surprise of my life is I just was about to graduate from high school when Pearl Harbor was bombed, and I remember the first thing I did was went out trying to sell newspapers at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, yelling on the streets, war declared or something like that, to that effect.
How big of a shock was that?
It was to make a few pennies for us.
How big of a shock was that to you, Norm, to hear that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
It struck me. As a high school boy, it struck us. The only one thing you want to do is roll up your sleeves and fight.
And how long did you wait before you got in the service?
I had to wait till I graduated high school. We had graduation in December and in June, and we had one graduating. I never went to my graduation because I had left by then in January of 1942.
And obviously, this is the Pacific War we're talking about. It was the Japanese that bombed Pearl Harbor, and that's the part of the war that you would serve in.
Well, that was the shock that shocked the whole country, what happened to Pearl Harbor. And in fact, I was about to join when word got out that if we went to a school for 6 weeks, they would get a job for us. And out of high school, I got a job at the Bremerton Navy Yards, where I worked for about 6 months, and I didn't like it, so I went back home and joined the Navy.
Huh. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Bremerton, because Seattle is where the gentleman who saved your life on the Bunker Hill was from.
That's correct. I lived at the YMCA on 4th Street in Seattle, and I used to take the ferry boat over to Bremerton, where I worked in the Navy Yards. In fact, while I was working there, the battleship Nevada from Pearl Harbor was towed in, and I actually worked on that battleship.
How about that? I wanted to ask you about something else. I mean, your experience was all in the Pacific War, but there was also a war in Europe, and in that war, the Jewish people were not only being persecuted, they were being executed. And it's just unthinkable what was done.
We knew nothing about it. You know, I sometimes use that, you know, I'm Jewish.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up.
I'm bringing it up is, and I'm a very proud Jew, and I'm proud to be a Jew. And in fact, I just listened last night to Netanyahu on television. And in any event, at that time, the communication with newspapers and what went on, I had no idea that Jews were being slaughtered in Germany. I probably would have fought with a deeper. I wasn't in that war, because when I joined the Navy, after I went to boot camp at Farragut, Idaho, they gave me the opportunity to go to electrical school at Treasure Island in San Francisco. And that's where I went to gyro school. I became to run the gyro compass on aboard ship.
And I want to talk about that. And it's occurring to me, all these memories that you're sharing, your story is so unique. Some of these memories...
The only thing I've got is a good memory. I can tell you my phone number of my house when I was a boy in grammar school.
But some of these memories disappeared for decades because of what you went through on the Bunker
Hill.
Well,
only what happened aboard ship. Mm-hmm. That's the part of my life. So I can remember just pieces and names and situations. But like, for example, when we got hit and we went to Ulithi. I don't remember going to Ulithi. I don't remember going to Pearl Harbor for minor repairs. I remember getting to Bremerton, because that's when I was in Bremerton Navy Yards being repaired. That's when the war ended.
So you did remember everything up until the point where you guys were kamikazed?
There's so many parts that I don't remember, and there's some that I do, and I can't tell you why. But I understand I did not know this. I had carbon monoxide poisoning, and in Maxwell Kennedy's book, there's a whole article about carbon monoxide poisoning where you do forget so many things. And I don't remember so much. I remember Al Scarrett, I'm getting ahead of it, how I got to.
Sure.
You want to hear it now or later?
Well, I'm thinking maybe what we should do is share the story of what triggered all these memories and how this all started to come back to the surface.
When I graduated from electrical school in San Francisco, the Bunker Hill was built on the East Coast and went through the Panama Canal. And when it came up, it came to San Francisco and was anchored out there. And when they told me to grab your sea bags, you're going on your ship, and they never tell you what ship you're going on. And this great big ship that basically was 25 stories high when I pulled up to it. And when I boarded the ship, my name was called out, and they told me that I am taking care of the gyro compass. Do you know what the gyro compass is?
Why don't you explain it for everybody listening?
Okay. The gyro compass is a big, it's almost like a wash tub floating. It's a motor that floats in mercury, and it goes 3,600 RPMs. And any time something goes 3,600 RPMs and is floating, it automatically points to north and stays north. And from there, you get your direction. I would send all the signals to the gun mounts, to any, to about 20, there's about 23 or 25 compasses throughout the ship. One of them was up in Mark Mitchell's office. In fact, one time I was called up to his office to repair it at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I met him for the first time. He was wearing his bathrobe and his baseball hat, and he had me have a cup of coffee when I finished working on it.
And this was an admiral who was in charge not just of your ship, but the whole fleet.
We were the flagship of the 7th Fleet.
Yeah. So you saw a different side of the big cheese there.
That's right.
So you're the gyro compass man, and this is a giant, giant aircraft
carrier.
The funny
thing, though, which and the one thing in the Navy, when they say jump, you ask how high. When I went aboard, they said, you're in charge of the gyro, and the gyro that they had was an Arma, and I learned on a Sperry. I remember Lieutenant Commander Carmichael was the chief engineer. I told him, I says, I don't know nothing about this one. He says, here's a book. We're leaving in 5 days. You better learn it. And that's what happened. But the Navy was like that. There were so many situations similar to that that we had to, you know, react on a dime and use your own judgment. And I'm sure it caused a lot of problems and a lot of good on both sides.
And you were a plank owner on the Bunker Hill,
correct? Plank owner, right. When we came back after the war was over, they took the hangar deck and converted it to 3,000 bunks were built on there. And set it, the level of the aircraft carrier is a hangar deck.
Right.
They took, instead of putting airplanes on there, the war was over. We went back to the Philippines with bunks of 3,000. We brought 3,000 Marines back from the Philippines, and that's when I got discharged.
And a lot happened in between. In those 18 months.
It was in 11 major battles. We were hit maybe 6-7 times. I've been through Bremerton for repairs. Then we went back out to sea. Then we got hit with the big one with two kamikazes. And that's something I'll never forget.
Yeah, and you guys would receive the presidential unit citation.
We got the presidential. In fact, my wife has got a whole wall here. You had a picture here. The whole hallway is all my memories.
Well, and I know so much of your story and your ability to tell your story centers around May 11th of 45 and what happened when you were hit.
1945 at 7:30 in the morning.
But I want to hear about before that, because you just gave us a taste. I mean, that was your 11th major battle of World War II.
I've been on every island in the South Pacific. I have 11 stars and the presidential citation.
Mm-hmm. And you have your life, and you have another sailor to thank for it, and we're going to hear about that. But
That's right.
I want to hear what you remember about some of those earlier battles before we get into Okinawa and when you were
there. Funny thing you say that. Would you believe this? I was on the ship for 3 years, and only once did I ever see a Japanese plane coming and firing at us. Why? Because although I was the chief gyro engineer, whenever the gong, gong, gong the battle stations were sounded, I was assigned to Engine Room 2, and my chief engineer was Joseph Carmichael, who was in Engine Room 1. And I would wear sound-powered phones, and he would give me instructions on when and how to switch generators to whatever he wanted, because he had his own way of running it. In fact, at one time after we were hit, the word spread around. I don't know if it was the captain who said it or scuttlebutt, whatever it was, abandoned ship. There was only three of us left in the engine room. We could not see down there, only because by going down there for 3 years, do you know your way around by feeling? We could not see. The smoke was so burnt. And I don't know if you're aware of it. They have a air duct that goes down to each engine room. It's about 6 feet wide. I used to sit under it and read the book. In fact, I read the book War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. Well, on watch because you're four on and eight off all around the clock. And I was in the engine room for 4 hours, and many times all you had to do is switch generators and nothing else to do. I'd read a book.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so hot down there. It was 130 degrees. I stood under the ventilator. But I found out that those two ventilators going down the engine rooms were improperly made at the shipbuilding plant. And it brought all and smoke and that down until it started exhausting it. The shaft, you know, I remember seeing the shaft after I came up, and afterwards the elevator shafts melted like butter. Now, when I was in the engine room, when they said abandon ship, we climbed up the ladder trying to get out, and you had a porthole door to open, and when the three of us were on the ladder, water poured down. The minute we opened, we had to close it in a hurry, and we knew that we couldn't get out. That's the only way to get out of the engine room was out through that one door. And there's one guy that they taught us that when they suffocate, they swallow their tongue. I took a pliers and tried to pull the tongue out of a guy, but it didn't work. He died. And then I don't remember anymore. I remember falling asleep somewhere. It's like going to sleep in a carbon monoxide poisoning. It's just like going to sleep.
Yeah.
And I remember going to sleep, and the next thing I know is there's somebody's carrying me, and that's Al Skerritt. And I never knew who he was because he brought me up to the flight deck and laid me on. I had no shoes on. I don't know what happened to my shoes. And later on I found my compartment was completely blown. I had no clothes to wear. I found a pillowcase and cut the corners out and used them for pants until we get to Ulithi, where I got some clothes to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And I wore a pillowcase with a piece of rope around me till we got to Ulithi. In fact, I wore the pillowcase to the funeral, the burial at sea, when that 10 at a time went over the side.
It's time for our first break, but we'll piece together more of Norm Lastman's story when we come back. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a link to the book that would fill in so many of the details in Norm's story and eventually lead him to the man who saved his life 72 years ago. If you haven't seen that award-winning TV report on their reunion from WGN in Chicago, you really need to check that out. It's online for you there as well. More from Norm when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 94-year-old Norm Lastman of Chicago, Illinois. Originally from St. Paul, Minnesota, and a plank owner, an original crew member of the aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill, which on May 11th, 1945, was struck by not just one, but two kamikazes, setting off a series of explosions and fires that would claim the lives of nearly 400 of Norm's fellow sailors, and came oh so close to claiming his life. And Norm, I know we heard a little bit about it, but let's get more of a taste of your experience aboard the Bunker Hill.
Whenever you have battle stations, you go immediately to the engine room. When they sound that gong, 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 that is battle stations, and everybody goes to your assigned battle station. Mine was engine room two. The last guy comes down, and you close the hatch, and you go about switching generators, and we took our orders from Lieutenant Commander Carmichael, Joseph Carmichael, who received the Navy Cross for what he did to save the ship, because he stepped in when the captain said abandon ship. He overtapped the captain and said, do not abandon ship. I am going to save the ship. And he did through his efforts of switching generators and boilers and water tanks. He balanced the ship so it could float out. It wasn't laying on its side. He brought it to an even keel.
Right.
I have in my book right now, Lieutenant Commander Carmichael saved my life.
Mm-hmm. So you spent most of your time in that engine room?
All the time.
Yeah.
130 degrees all the time.
You started to tell me about one of the rare times where you came out of the engine room. You said where you had to climb up and change the searchlight.
Oh, this was under, there was no battle station then. I was just going up to change the carbonite arc on the searchlight. And while I was up there, I heard general quarters. That means I got to get to the engine room. And here I am, 10 minutes up of walk. Takes 10 minutes at least to climb up to the highest point of the ship to change the carbon arcs. So they close all hatches after, I think it's 3 minutes or 5 minutes. They close all hatches in the ship, and nobody can move anywhere. Well, I made it down to the gun mount, the 40-millimeter gun mount, and I just curled up in the curve of the gun mount. And I actually saw when the plane's coming, diving in and shooting, and the guy who manned my 40-millimeter, I saw him get killed. And I couldn't help him. I knew nothing about how to run a 40-millimeter.
You spent so much time on this ship. You have situations like that. And even when you're down in the engine room, I mean...
In the engine room, you could hear all the fighting, but I could not see it. They were talking on the phone. You could hear the guns going off, the 40-millimeters, the 6-inch guns and all. But I never saw any of it. Because you're down in the engine room, seeing anything.
Yeah. Well, I guess my question is, what's scarier, seeing it or being down where you can't see it, but still knowing that danger?
I never stopped to think of it, and you're the first person that's asked that question. I don't know the answer to that one. I really don't. I saw movies of what the bunker hill went through and the Japanese planes diving down and shooting, but that's only in movies. I actually never saw a plane except that time I came down from the carbon arc and I couldn't make it into the engine room.
That's the one time where you actually see that danger. But
I actually saw a plane diving down and saw what it looked like to see bullets coming out of their wings.
Right. I guess my question is, even though you're not seeing that every day, you're hearing it. You're aware of the threat that way. You're aware of the threat of submarines. I mean, there's so many different things that could happen to your ship. Didn't that scare you? Didn't that make you concerned that you might not make it home?
Funny thing, I was never scared. I don't know why.
I think I would have been. Holy moly.
No, I don't recall anything. Like I said, it's something that you thought that's your day-to-day thing, and they talked about it at boot camp. They talked about it in school. I never had the feeling of being afraid. We had a job to do. We had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't stop and worry, were you going to die or were you going to live? It was the thing that was your job to do, and you just had to do it.
So on May the 11th of 45, you guys are hit by one kamikaze and then another.
There were three totally. It was described to me. I never saw it.
Right.
Three were diving at us. One was shot down. Two dove into us. In fact, Max Kennedy interviewed the family of the kamikazes in Japan.
Right, and that's part of his book, Danger's Hour.
In Danger's Hour. Now you're getting to the part of how I learned it. My memory was gone, period. I couldn't tell the story. When I came home to St. Paul, Minnesota, then 6 months later I moved to Chicago, and I've been here ever since. But I could not tell a story about what happened to me because my memory wasn't with it, so I find best they don't talk about it. And somehow when I came home, I had no medals. All my medals were gone. My uniform disappeared. I had no idea, and I didn't seem interested. I got a job, and on my job, I never talked about it with anybody. Knew I was in the Navy. I never wore any medals on my back until Danger's Hour came out. As I read the book, and I have to repeat this, I have read the book, I'd say 10, 12 times over and over. I got to know what happened to me then. I did not know it when it actually happened. The book told me what happened to me. Maxwell Kennedy did such a thorough job of going and meeting these guys at their reunions, which I was invited to it, but I have to say this, I couldn't afford to go there. So I just never went to a reunion. So I never met Max Kennedy before. My first experience of meeting Max Kennedy was when he came to the book signing. I wanted to meet him. I didn't know how to reach him, but his brother owned the merchandise mart here in Chicago, Chris Kennedy. And I called the merchandise mart, and I talked to Chris Kennedy's secretary, and I told her, she said, wait a while, you were on the Bunker Hill? I said, yes, I was. She says, are you coming to the book signing? And I says, I plan to. She says, how would I know what you look like? And I said, wait a while, I got a Bunker Hill, wear it. And don't know, that's me. I wore the hat, and when he met me, and he came over, she brought him over to me. He had me stand up, and he told me, I actually started to cry. He was telling me things that I never knew happened to me. He knew everything about Lieutenant Commander Carmichael, because that's the first question they asked me. Who was your commanding officer? And I says, Lieutenant Commander Carmichael. I did not know he was the hero of the ship.
Because this had just been out of sight, out of mind for 60 years.
Everything was out of sight, out of mind. I had no memory. I couldn't tell a story to my own family what happened. What I'm telling you, I couldn't tell my own family because I know. No, it took the book and reading and reading and reading over and over and making a few phone calls and talking to people. And while I was at the book signing, I met a guy by the name of Mike Mahoney. His brother was a rear gunner on a bomber on our ship. His brother was aboard ship when we were hit. And he came also to the book signing, and that's when I first met him. I did not know he was involved with honor flights. And from that day on, the combination of Mike Mahoney, Mary Pettinato, and honor flights came into my life. And the more I read the book, the more knowledgeable and I could begin speaking because I started to know more about what happened to me after I read the book.
So reading this book and
reading the book restored my, I would say, 75% of my memory.
Wow. That must have been exciting for you to have this start to come into focus again.
I used to stay up all night reading my book. Then I'd read it, put it down, and I'd read it another day, but I have it right in front of me, right here with his picture and me, shaking hands at the book signing. Then Pam Grimes, the producer here of WGN in Chicago, got wind of it all, and then she turned it into a movie where I did a show, and she won a national award for the best half-hour show on television that year. My story was going on honor flights, showing me coming home from honor flights, and as I sat on the airplane coming home. In fact, we're going out this Sunday to dinner with the photographer who was on the plane and put the microphone around me and interviewed me, and that was the start of my whole life. I have so much stored up in me. It all came about in the past 9 years since Honor Flights.
Right, right.
So the combination of Honor Flights and the book come out was the beginning of my whole life. Prior to that, I couldn't tell a story about it.
Right, and the reason you couldn't tell the story was after your ship got hit and you get trapped in the engine room, you got up to that hatch once, the water's coming through, you're thinking, we can't get out there. The other guys in this compartment are dying around you. You can't save them.
Everyone's dead.
But Al Skerritt told the story that he heard pounding on the hatch of that engine room.
I must have been pounding. I didn't know I was pounding.
Your consciousness was to the point you didn't even know what you're doing because you're oxygen deprived.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
He heard me pounding on the door.
And you probably didn't have much more time before you would have been dead.
Yeah, I wouldn't, that far away.
But none of this is part of your memory for decades, for
none
more than 60 years.
None of it is in my memory.
More than 60 years, you didn't know what happened to you. You read the book, it starts to come together.
It then all come together in that book.
And then you go on the honor flight. And what was that honor flight experience like for you with Honor Flight Chicago?
Greatest thing that's happened to my life, honor flights. When I see honor flights, I stand up. I'm a very proud American. I give you, I'm coming out of left field. I won't watch a football game anymore. If anybody kneels, they won't stand up to my flag. I don't even want to watch them play anymore. That's how I feel.
And you're not the only veteran who feels that way, I don't think.
No. Like I said, I am very proud that I went. I am not sorry for anything. We lost a lot of lives. From what I understand, in the book it says where we were the worst suicide attack ever done to this country until 9/11.
Yeah, 390 people.
392 killed. Guys died. And I went with the sheet wrapped around me to the funeral.
After this attack that killed more than 390.
When I came up, I would say it was in a day or two afterwards they had the funeral. You know, they buried him at sea.
Right.
And they threw 10 at a time, and we would all stand and salute as they were dropped into the water.
How hard was that to watch?
Terrible. That was the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. Cried like a baby. You don't know who's in this bag, but, you know, there's bodies in there.
Well, you lost some guys that you had been working with every day in that engine room.
I lost a lot of friends. Like, I remember one named Carl Foltz who worked with me. The Ranger was the first aircraft carrier ever, and he served on the Ranger, and I saw him die. I knew him, and every day I talked with him. I learned so much from him. He made Chief Petty Officer while he was aboard ship.
We're talking about what happened to you May 11th, 1945, on the USS Bunker Hill. More than 390 people died. You survived. Al survived. Another guy who survived that is a name that everybody knows. Paul Newman, the actor, was aboard your ship.
So was Ed McMahon. Did you know that?
Ed McMahon, the TV host, and
that's
I know.
Right. And so was Wayne Morse, a movie star. You mentioned Paul Newman.
Yeah.
I've got here a printout that he was aboard ship, and I never knew he was. He was supposed to take off the day of the when we got hit. From what I understand, he had some problem with his eyes or something. He couldn't fly go off that. He was on the plane.
Yeah, he was an Avenger gunner on those.
That's right. He was a
TBS.
Rear gunner. I did not know that till about 3-4 years ago, that Paul Newman was aboard at our ship, and Ed McMahon, who's Johnny Carson's sidekick, was aboard ship.
Well, if the planes had hit a little different, maybe some of those famous names wouldn't have had the careers they've had.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have seen all those films. And,
you
know, obviously this almost claimed your life, too. And you
That's
told
right.
us how you read the book, the memories start flooding back.
That's all of that. You start reading all these books. I've got enough books here. It's unbelievable.
And one of those books, Max Kennedy's book, Danger's Hour, would lead you to Al Skerritt, who just passed away October 6th. But before that, shared this account of rescuing Norm from the engine room.
Oh, I heard this pounding on this escape hatch, and it was from the engine room. And I opened up the escape hatch, and here there was a sailor. He was rum-dum, and he wanted to get out, and I tried to help him out, but he was too heavy. And so I saw another sailor walking by, and I had him to come over and help me. And he helped me get this guy out of this escape hatch.
So that's how Al remembered it, Norm. And I know we keep coming back to this, but what do you remember about those moments from your perspective?
I used to sit under this blower. There's a, like each engine room has a blower bringing air, supposedly to bring air, but I understand it was not made right on the East Coast, but it didn't perform its duties the way it should. And it brought all the smoke and dirt and debris from the explosions and the planes blowing up, brought everything down those areas. We could not see. When Commander Carmichael was telling me to switch generators, I had to take my shirt or rip my shirt off and wipe the dials. I couldn't see the dials to be able to switch generators because I was the only one left down there. Nobody else was responding. When we had to go back down, apparently the other two guys died. I must have been the only one. And then next thing I know, I'm in the arms and I smell nothing but burning flesh. I mean, it goes down there, there's all dead bodies there. And I find out later that Al Skerritt, the guy who carried me out, he laid me on the flight deck, and the medical crew took care of me. I remember them asking me, do you want to go to the Bonneville, the hospital ship? And I looked at him. I said, no, I'm fine now. I was sitting on the deck. I was not standing. I looked at all the bodies that were burned that night. I says, I don't have to go to the hospital ship. They need more help.
Wow, and none of us who weren't there can even try to fathom what this was like. The devastation, the chaos, the nightmare of it all. photos can help, and we do have photographs from the Bunker Hill as it appeared after the attacks of May 11th, 1945, posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. First-hand accounts like Norm's and Al's help us even more to understand. But you might not be clear yet on how these two sailors connected 72 years after one saved the other's life aboard that aircraft carrier. We'll have Norm explain how those dots connected when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to complete a story we first told you about a couple weeks ago through the voice of Al Skerritt, who passed away October 6th at the age of 97. But the final year of Al's life was highlighted by a newfound friendship with the sailor whose life he had saved on the aircraft carrier Bunker Hill on May 11th, 1945. And we're hearing from that sailor today, 94-year-old Norm Lastman of Chicago, Illinois, who for decades didn't know exactly what had happened to him on the ship or who had saved his life. His journey of discovery, his cracking open of that chapter in his history, involved a best-selling book by Max Kennedy, the youngest son of Robert F. Kennedy, and it also was spurred on and accelerated by Norm's involvement with Honor Flight Chicago, part of the National Honor Flight Network dedicated to taking veterans free of charge to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. Just this last week, I got to see a huge red, white, and blue crowd welcome home 67 World War II and Korean War veterans who enjoyed that experience with Central Valley Honor Flight, where I live here in California. It really never, never gets old. Goosebumps every single time. And I know that's the case in the Windy City, too, where Honor Flight Chicago co-founder Mary Pettinato is the one who connected me to you, Norm. Maybe you can share with us now about Honor Flight Chicago and what it has meant to you.
Honor Flight opened so many doors for me, and I actually fell in love with the organization and the people. And I just go wherever they went. They say something to do with Honor Flights, and most of my talking turns from what I'm telling you in the military, I switch to Honor Flights and tell them what it does.
Well, and that's, I want to know what it was about that experience that struck you to that degree. Can you remember that
and the things
that happened and what you experienced?
All the things were new to me. I'd never been in Washington, D.C. before. The World War II Memorial is utterly phenomenal. I was there and I went through the whole procedure. They take the pictures and everything else. The biggest thrill I got was when I landed at Midway Airport, and I couldn't figure out the water show that the fire department shoots over each plane. When I'm coming off and I'm coming out of the runway and I hear all this music and people, I says, geez, it must be the President of the United States going to be there. I knew what I was doing. And when I saw all of that, those 3,000 people down there were applauding me and other veterans are aboard. I think we had about 105, 110 guys aboard the plane.
How'd that make you feel?
I couldn't even put it in writing. It's the greatest single feeling I've ever had in my life. When I stood there and I heard the noise and I heard the bands playing and I saw the flags waving, it made like a ton of bricks in my heart.
Beautiful.
I says, I am so proud to be an American.
Well, tell me how this happened. What was it that triggered the realization that Al Skerritt out in Seattle was the sailor who had saved your life? How did you figure that out?
I'm glad you brought that up. I've got a neighbor two doors down who's a World War II buff. Right now he's about 65 years old, and he took a liking to me. And he loved to come talk to me about World War II. And I didn't mind talking to him, and I'm telling him a lot of things that I just told you. He also is a smartphone individual. He's on that. He talks to it all the time, and it talks back to him and tells him things. He also is a Chicago White Sox fan, and I mean a real fan. Like, he won't go to a Cub game, but he'll watch the Sox lose. But that's okay. That's what he loves, the White Sox. He used to come over here and we'd sit and talk, and I'd show him pictures, what I had, and I'd tell him stories. And he says, you know what? And I told him what I just told you about Al Skerritt. I just found out that the guy who saved me. He says, wait a while. The guy's in Seattle. I'm there next week to a game. Him and his wife go to 3-4 Sox games throughout the country where the Sox are playing, and they make a weekend out of it. He went to Seattle, and if you should see the movie of Al and I, he is in the movie with me. And I'll back it up for a minute. And when I told him that, he went to Seattle. He looked up on his smartphone, and he talked to the family members of Al Skerritt. He says, and he comes back, and he says, Norm, Al Skerritt is still alive. I thought he was dead. He's still alive. I've got his phone number. So I called Skerritt, and he almost fell off the chair when I talked to him. I says, you're talking to Norm Lamb, didn't know who I was. I says, I'm the guy you carried out of the engine room. And he almost fell off the chair. He says, I don't believe it. And we talked to each other at least a dozen times until he died. And I've talked to his daughter and his son, and I never got to see him.
So in reading the book, you see the account of Al Skerritt saving someone from the engine room. And you said, that's got to be me?
That'd be me.
Couldn't have been anyone else.
No, there was nobody else.
So your friend goes to a White Sox game. He's in Seattle. He looks up Al Skerritt. You make the connection. You guys talk on the phone.
And that's how I got to Al Skerritt, is through this day.
You never did get to meet him in person, but you to see his face.
I didn't know him then, and I don't know him now personally. I only know his voice.
But you did get to see his face on Skype.
On Skype. I looked at him, and just as while we're on Skype, Max Kennedy flew in from Los Angeles and sat down next to him. I nearly died.
Well, what was it like for you to see the face man who saved you?
I was awestruck because he was such a smiling guy at 97 years old. He had all his wits. He had everything except his hearing was bad. But he raised his volume up and I could talk to him.
I mean, I'm sure when the book came out and you read the book and your memory started flooding back, that was exciting. But you couldn't have imagined that you would actually get a chance to talk to and see the face of the guy who saved you.
In fact, him and I got the two letters. You wrote each other two letters, and I got the two letters here that he wrote me.
Is that a little hard for you to believe that all of this has happened all years?
You're making me dig up. Now it's hard to choke me up a little bit. It's hard to believe it all.
Yeah, how do you explain the fact that this has happened for you?
I can't explain it. I can't explain it. It's just the feeling of how proud I was. And I'm sorry I was that I never knew him. He must have been a great guy. I just now lost all the words that I want to say. I'm emotional right now, knowing where it's going from here. I've told this story to other people, to Al and other people, but now I know it's going to go on the air somewhere. It's going to go out in conjunction with you were out to see Al, and that's the one thing I feel sorry that I never had the opportunity to shake. I saw him on Skype, but I did not shake hands with him.
Well, I'll tell you, I can say from the time I spent with him in Seattle that just talking to you and getting your letters and seeing you on Skype and having all that come back around 72 years later just meant the world to him. And just to know that you are still alive and to hear about the life that you've had, I know it was extremely gratifying and fulfilling for him to have that knowledge in his final year of life.
Yeah. It's starting to sink into me, and I'll be cherishing more from here on in.
What's been the most amazing element of all of this, Norm, from the book to Honor Flight to getting to know Al? What has this done for you, and what still is hard for you to fathom now?
I would say, point blank, it's made me look at that flag and says, I am glad I fought for it. I didn't wish a war on us, nobody like that. But if I had to, this country is the greatest country in the world.
And you mentioned your involvement with Honor Flight Chicago, that you go around giving a lot of speeches, even as you approach your 95th birthday.
Wherever I get a chance to go do something for Honor Flights, whether it raise money or speak or be there, I can't do it up for Honor Flights.
Why do you do that? Why is that so important?
It's something I love. I think that's what I have to line them up. Max Kennedy, Honor Flights, the Navy. I'm sorry a war went through that I went through, but I have no regrets. I'm grateful that I'm able to restore the memories that I thought I had lost. I think I've had it all. I'm ready anytime the good Lord wants. And one thing that's great, I want to live forever, but truthfully, what I think family, a mother and a father and sisters and brothers, and be raised in a home. I was raised in a home where there was no food, but I remember we didn't sit at the table until my dad sat down at the table. Even though he didn't have a job, he was out looking for a job. The family together. When there's family, something grows out of a family. And that's what's wrong in the world. There's no family anymore.
Well, in light of that, when you think about what you fought for, is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
There's two stripes in the ball on my sleeve and my sailor hat. And sailing under the bridge, the Oakland Bay Bridge, as in people throwing silver coins at us as we stood at attention on the flight deck, the fond memory of. I am proud to be in the Navy, and I would do it again tomorrow if I had to do it over again.
And I guess I've got to ask you this, too. Living all these years, the last 72 years, knowing how close you came to not surviving May 11th of 1945, did that change your perspective? Did that change the way that you approached life, knowing how close you came to dying?
It was automatic. Fighting the war, all that, 72 years, I didn't look at it from 72 years or whatever I was in. I've had parents who have brought their children to my house to talk to me, and I says, if you go get an education, but if you can't get an education, join the military, stay in it for 20 years, get the pension, come out, and you can start a new career. If your kid does that at 18 years old, today's world is better off.
How many kids and grandkids do you have, Norm?
I just became a great-grandfather. She's 6 months old. I have 3 children and 4 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild.
You ever think that right there, the ones you just listed, that's 8 people who would have never been born if Al Skerritt didn't pull you out of that engine room?
I told that to Al. I said, if it wasn't for you, I would have never been here to have the family that I got. And I told him about my family. And it's true. I thought of that many times. If it wasn't for Al, I would not be here at all. And I wouldn't be able to have it. And I love my kids. I have one daughter who lives in Austin, Texas, very successful. A son who's a very successful in real estate in Boca Raton. And then I have a special needs child. He's now 63 years old. And he lives in Florida where his older brother is his guardian down there. And he lives down there in Boca Raton. God's given me everything that I need. We make you work harder for the mentally handicapped and those in the special needs children. So having a child like that maybe was blessed for me to have one.
Amen. Well, Norm, I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that I think raises all our eyebrows, and we say, wow, look at the timing, the way you got to know Al.
I am proud to be an American. If I would do it over again, I'd want to fight for this country. This country is worth fighting for. That's all I can tell you.
Well, I guess I can ask you this, my final question.
Don't ask me anything you want.
Well, let me ask you about Al. I was just with him a few weeks ago. Now he's gone. And you got to know him just in time while he was still here.
That is something that I learned from the lady I live with. She walks with God while on earth. And I got to tell you, she taught me how to be with God. Now, she's Catholic and I'm Jewish. I'll be very frank with you. And I go to Mass with her. And I don't kneel, but I go to Mass. The priests come down and shake my hand and said shalom to me. They all know I'm Jewish, and I'm very proud of being a Jew.
So you're saying you think God orchestrated your opportunity to meet
Al? Absolutely. Without God, there is nobody. And we do it God's way, and it'll be right. She goes and lights a candle for Al already.
Well, that was my question. How should Al be remembered?
I would say as a God-fearing man. He loved God, and he loved his country, and he fought for his country. Love is where it's all at. And the bottom line is when you give love and get love, you're a rich man. Not how much money you got in the bank. You can't take that with you. That's how I feel. I ain't got no money, but I got a lot of love.
I know the feeling, Norm. I know the feeling.
But, you sum it up that's what life is all about. I don't know how much money you got. You can't take it with you, but you can sure take God with you. She taught me how to love God the way you're supposed to love him.
Well, and I know she loves you, and I think we can all tell how Norm Lastman feels about his wife, Carol. I know this wasn't as linear a process as usual here on Hometown Heroes, but I trust you followed that bouncing ball and got a glimpse not just of what Norm went through, but also this incredible journey he's been on recently and how it has energized him to reach out and impact lives around him. If you haven't seen that television piece on Norm and Al Skerritt from WGN, I know I've mentioned it a couple times, but it is a must-see. You'll find it linked at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm so thankful I had the opportunity to sit down with Al Skerritt before it was too late. I know how much Norm meant to him, and I don't think any of us would be able to miss today just how fondly Norm will remember Al and how he will continue to honor his legacy. That's the program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.